Welcome to a podcast called Intrepid. My name's Craig Forces. I'm here with Stephanie Carvin at the Norman Patterson School of International Affairs, high above the Rideau River. And Stephanie, today we have a session for geeks who are interested in warrantry.
Law nerds rejoice.
Yes. So warrantry is actually a really cool term. You asked me last time I talked about this, whether it's a real word.
If you look it up
in the dictionary, actually warrantry, it's a condition in a contract and stuff like that. But warrantry is actually the neologism that they use in Britain to describe what we call lawful access, that is authorization to intercept, that is acquiring warrants, that sort of stuff.
The look of glee on your face is way too happy. Yes. Audience, I wish you could see
this. This is our opportunity to talk about warrantry because we've got three cases that implicate warrantry that just came out. We're recording this on December 4th, and so they came out last week. So one Supreme Court case, one case from the Ontario Superior Court, and one from the federal court. And then we actually have a fourth case that's not related to warrantry, but is another favorite topic, Canada Evidence Act and disclosure in the context of, in this case, it's a civil proceeding involving Sharkawi, who is quite a famous figure in Canadian jurisprudence. And so hopefully we'll have enough time to sort of weave a tale about the first three cases and then maybe an add-on talking about the Sharkawi.
It's like a whole advent calendar of court cases.
It is. So okay. We have a bit of an order here because we are going to try to link these.
Okay, right. So the first one we're going to talk about is the Peshtari decision that came out last week. Now, if you've been listening to us at all, Peshtari is a case of a guy who's, he's kind of been around the terrorism trials before. He was originally arrested as a part of a plot in 2010 here in Ottawa. The charges were dropped, but then he's been charged with regards to facilitating travel of individuals to the Islamic State, or tried to go. Two other individuals have already, I believe, pled guilty, the people he was trying to facilitate, but he has decided to go to trial, and there was a decision in the case.
Yeah, well, a decision on a collateral issue in the case. So we haven't actually got to the merits, like, is he guilty or is he not? So there's no decision on the merits. That trial proceeds. But for those who have listened to this podcast regularly, this has been a feast for geeky law issues. And so some of the geeky law issues have been, for instance, part of the genesis for the police investigation was actually information collected by the Canadian Security Intelligence Service, CSIS.
Right, yes.
Which then flipped the information over to the RCMP, which got a warrant. And the product of that police warrant is part of the evidence being used against Mr. Peshtari. And so the dominoes, they line up to the CSIS information, and the CSIS information was collected under a CSIS warrant. And so if the defense counsel, Solomon Freeman, can knock out the CSIS warrant, the dominoes fall, and the information that was generated by the RCMP intercept will also fall. And so there was an effort to knock out the CSIS warrant and say it was unlawfully issued by the federal court. That effort seems now to have come to an end, at least seems to have come to an end. In the summer, the federal court ruled that the warrant was properly issued, the CSIS warrant. Then the case that we're going to talk about today.
So the federal court found that the federal court did okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. So that's what's known as the Garofoli process. So it's
you have. So it sounds very festive. Garofoli.
Garofoli.
So my favorite time of year.
So the secondary issue was at the same time, Peshtari and his counsel were challenging the constitutionality itself of CSIS warrants. And that's the decision that came out last week. And so we'll talk about that.
So basically, in other words, he's saying that the entire CSIS warrant process is
unconstitutional. Mr. Peshtari said it was unconstitutional, right?
Right. And that would be a problem.
That would be a problem. So we'll talk about that. The other case that we need to talk about is another warrant case. And this is actually, it might actually be useful for listeners who have the time to listen to our episode 15, where we talked about a couple of cases that came out just about a year ago. The first case was the collection of IMSI numbers. So the numbers generated by cell phones.
Yes.
And whether that was a search for which...
Under Section 8 of the
Charter. And we'll talk about what that is in a second, because we have to refresh everyone's minds. And whether, therefore, it required a warrant. That first case...
After that episode, I literally emailed the federal government to get them to send me a copy of the Charter, which I now have stapled to my dresser.
So the outcome of that case was the court concluded it was a search, but this was a circumstance where there could be warrantless intercept of the IMSI number itself. But there was a second case issued at the same time in which the service was trying to get what it calls basic identifier information, or BII, which, as I understand the discussion in one of the cases we'll talk about today, is basically telephone and email addresses, right? Or identifiers that are tied to electronic communication in some way. And there, the service was turned down for reasons we'll talk about, because they came back to court and generated this most recent case.
Right. So, okay.
So that's case number two.
Right.
Case number three is Vice Media, which probably most of our listeners heard about, right?
Right.
So this is this case that came out from the Supreme Court last week about, in this case, it was a police production order obliging Vice Media to cough up information in its possession related to its interview with Mr. Sheridan.
Right. Mr. Sheridan, who was a an individual who joined the Islamic State.
Yeah, believed to be killed.
Bad life choice. But he was being interviewed by Vice Media about his decision to go over there and why he thought this was great. So the RCMP wanted information related to the interviews that Vice Media had done.
And so they sought a production order, which is a form, generally speaking, of warrant. Were given a production order, and the Vice Media then appealed to the Court of Appeal and from there to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court, to cut to the chase, said that while we're going to tinker a little bit with the test in circumstances where a production order, and by extension, I would say any kind of warrant, is issued in relation to the media, we're not going to disallow it. And in this case, it was a reasonable production order.
So in all of these cases, we're dealing with threats to the security of Canada. And so
in general terms, right? So, although the third case was a police investigation. So it was it was a production order under the criminal code, so it wasn't a part six wiretap. We should explain all this. I'll get to this in a second, but it was a terrorism investigation.
Okay.
So to the extent that we would include terrorism as in a colloquial and legal sense as being a threat to the security of Canada, yeah, these were all threat-related investigations, two related to the service and than one that is related to a criminal investigation by the police. The last case, if we have time to talk about, is the Sharkawi, the latest in the Sharkawi decisions. And so Sharkawi, famous figure in jurisprudence, as I've suggested, he is suing the government of Canada based on his treatment while he was subjected to security certificates under the Immigration Refugee Protection Act. And to sue in civil court, he wants disclosure from the government, and the government's not giving him disclosure and is claiming privilege under what's known as Section 38 of the Canada Evidence Act in relation to national security.
I know that
right?
one.
So, and that's an interesting case because it engages the third party rule or originator control, which is a concept we haven't talked about yet, I don't think, on this podcast. Although
so
I forget what
this,
we talked about.
Because, you know, the people want their warrantry.
Yeah, everyone wants their warrantry. All right, so do you want me just to do like the 100-foot primer on Section 8 privacy, why you need a warrant, and that sort of stuff?
Why don't you let me try and you tell me if I'm wrong.
Okay.
Let's do law professor style. So Section 8 is basically, it's about a search. You are protected under the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms from unreasonable search and seizure.
Great.
But basically over time, our idea of what a search is has changed because of modern technology. So like, for example, if you are arrested, can the police actually go through your phone? Well, it depends. So, but in terrorism trials, this is becoming more and more important because terrorists, like the rest of us, are storing more of their data on things like their phones. Basically, in the last, I would say, 5 years, we've gone through all these cases that are kind of really defining what a search actually is. So, for example, you talked about the MC case that we talked about in episode 15, which basically is, you know, can the government actually conduct searches on a phone number, you know, based on looking for the particular identifying information about a particular phone, which is the MC number, and how it's actually being used to kind of trace how these people are performing. Now, in that particular case we talked about, the court found that CSIS had actually refined its process to the point that the search was targeted enough that it didn't actually violate privacy and that this was an okay method for them to use. But it was very predicated along a lot of, because it's this targeted and this tailored and all these things, it's okay. But it doesn't
Content, doesn't interfere with the emergency line, 911, that
exactly.
sort of stuff. Yeah.
So did I pass?
Yes. No, that's very good.
Yes!
So, you're dead on, right? So the concept of what's a search. So once upon a time when we started talking about protections and back in the common law.
When do I get my law degree?
Yeah, that's right. you should get like advanced credit.
Right? Thank you.
Once upon a time, it was purely territorial, right?
Right.
So that old phrase, the Englishman's home is the their castle,
mm-hmm.
right? That actually is sort of tied historically to this idea that you couldn't invade the physical premises of an individual for search purposes. Well, of course, as you've suggested, we become much more mobile in the information we spit out in our daily lives. And so the concept of search has expanded. You can go back to 1990, and the Supreme Court said that electronic intercept is a search and therefore is protected by Section 8, right? And so there's this continuing evolution of what we mean by search. There's this
test. And we're not the only country going through this. Literally everyone's going through this.
The Supreme Court in the United States has had to contemplate this recently in cases like Carpenter and elsewhere. Yeah. So the issue is, you know, so first of all, there's a test, which is a completely opaque test called the totality of the circumstances, right? So where do you have a constitutional a protection in relation to search? Well, it's in circumstances where you've got a reasonable expectation of privacy. Where do you have a reasonable expectation of privacy? Well, where in the totality of circumstances, it exists,
yeah.
Right? And there's a test that's applied, the most important prong of which is whether objectively you should have a reasonable sense that what you're doing is private. And so that's really where the heavy lifting is done. And that really requires some careful calibration by the court when it contemplates new technologies, everything from, you know, heat detectors trying to detect marijuana plants, which I suppose are going out of business, or issues around personal computers and how do we treat personal computers? Do we treat them like a suitcase or do we treat them as something a little bit different than a suitcase because of the personal information that might be enclosed in them?
And now that you could unlock a phone with your face,
right.
It's becoming a lot easier.
Yeah. So this is always a moving target in terms of what constitutes a search.
So basically a warrant is required where you do have that reasonable expectation of privacy.
Generally speaking, the warrant. Yes. So the warrant is the gold standard. And so by warrant here, we mean pre-authorization by an independent judicial officer. It doesn't have to be a judge or a court per se, but it has to be someone capable of acting judicially.
Right.
And so that pre-authorization, typically we call it a warrant. There are other terms we use in our law. So for example, so we just talked about search, but there's also the seizing documents.
Right.
Yeah, so it's not just electronic intercepts, it's also police going into a premises and taking papers. That would be a seizure. The police can compel a third party to produce those papers through what's known as a production order. So there are various forms of search warrants and production orders.
And so that really affects 1, 2, and 3 of our cases.
Yeah, it does. Now, there is also the prospect, by the way, of warrantless searches, and sometimes those are constitutional. And so in circumstances where the search is authorized by law, the law itself is reasonable, and that requires one that strikes a reasonable balance between privacy and the state interest, and also the manner of the search or seizure itself was reasonable. If those three prongs are met, the court will occasionally...
Could you give
an
example?
Well, the IMSI.
Okay.
The IMSI is a classic example of
But they targeted it so exactly. much and so specifically.
All those predicate aspects,
yeah.
You can go back to episode 15 and we walk through them. All those predicate aspects that narrowed the scope of the search and limited its invasiveness were enough to persuade the court that was an okay warrantless search. It was still a search, but it was okay to do it warrantlessly.
Yeah.
And they're comparatively rare, by the way, warrantless searches, because, the gold standard is going to be an advance authorization by an independent judicial officer, at least when we're talking about law enforcement and also now in practice for intelligence. A little bit different for regulatory bodies.
Right.
So let's turn then to the issue in Peshtari, right? And so if the police can get warrants, and they can get different sorts of warrants, right? They can get this, you mentioned Part 6. So Part 6 of the Criminal Code is electronic intercepts of private communications, which are effectively electronic communication. They can also be any form of oral communication, by the way,
right?
Where you have an expectation of privacy. So for example, you and I are talking, we're recording this, so we probably don't have an expectation of privacy.
No, we do not.
But you know, the things we say when this thing's not running.
Right.
Yeah, so if someone had-
Or that we edit out.
Yes, if someone had a parabolic mic and it was on the Rideau River in a canoe and was aiming that parabolic mic at this window and was recording our conversation, that would be an intercept of a private communication and would raise Part 6 issues. There's some exceptional circumstances like exigency, but generally speaking, if you do that without either consent or judicial authorization, that's a crime. You could go to jail for 5 years.
Right.
So that rule dates from 1974, by the way. So that's an old expectation. All right. So there's a judicial authorization process for intercepts of that sort for police. Then there's regular search warrants. And then there's what are called production orders, and there are several sorts of production orders. There's general production orders, which are the ones that issue in the Vice case, which basically cough up these papers we're looking for. And the papers can have content, right? So it's content rich. And then there are other production orders that really don't have content, but deal with things like metadata. So a transmission data production order. So you go to a communications service provider and you say-
Like Rogers or Bell. Yeah,
we want all of Stephanie Carvin's metadata.
Everyone wants that.
Right, yeah. So you can get that through this transmission data production order. There is a distinction we'll get to in a second in terms of what the police have to show. There's a different standard depending on whether it's content rich or not. And this is a area of some controversy. But the police have a whole bunch of different little levels of judicial authorization. What does CSIS have?
They basically, for their investigations,
yeah.
At the warrant level, it's Section 21.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah.
Right? So they got like a one size fits all warrant.
Yeah. To be fair,
from the federal court.
pre-warrant, there are other levels of investigations that they have.
Yeah.
But by and large, I mean, like, once you're, like, using the sharp end of the stick, you're looking at Section 21.
Yeah, and by sharp end of the stick, you mean basically any circumstance in which Section 8 is engaged because it's a search or seizure.
That would be the legal definition.
I.e. where you've got a reasonable expectation of privacy. Yeah. Or in other circumstances, although the two would overlap, where you're doing an electronic intercept and otherwise you go to jail under Part 6. Yeah. Right? You want to exonerate yourself from Part 6 culpability, and you do that under the CSIS Act by getting a warrant.
Right. And I mean, but the threshold is high. I always say to people, you know, the federal courts, I've seen, you know, they turn these things down. They say this is not, you haven't done your homework, go back. But they are, of course, you know, this isn't the first rodeo. So, you know, CSIS is, you know, they have a whole team that is dedicated to getting these things and they know what they're doing. So, you know, the threshold is they have to believe. You have to have enough information to believe that someone is a threat to the security.
Reasonable grounds to believe.
Reasonable grounds to believe.
Right.
And everything has to be reasonable.
And that's also the standard for your regular search warrants for the police, their Part 6 authorizations, and for content-rich production orders. Reasonable grounds to believe, which is a credibly based probability analysis. So you have to have credible evidence of a probability that the thing you're investigating exists.
Yes.
So for the service, what are you investigating?
Threats to the security of Canada.
Yeah, or it could be foreign intelligence, but typically it's going to be security intelligence, right? So threats to the security of Canada, which means espionage, sabotage, terrorism, foreign influenced activities, or in principle subversion.
Yeah.
And what are police investigating? They have to have a reasonable grounds to believe there's been a
crime,
right?
Yeah.
So
or going to be.
And this becomes important, or they're trying to preempt that crime, yes. So that becomes important for this Peshtari case we'll get to. One final point, though, before we get there. So reasonable grounds to believe is the classic standard across warrantry. So again, it's a probability-based standard. They have to have enough evidence to demonstrate the probability of the thing they're investigating. Well, there has been a relaxation for some non-content-rich forms of warrantry. And so those production orders for metadata, transmission data, there the standard is reasonable grounds to suspect,
okay,
which is the possibility, not the probability, that the thing you're investigating exists.
But they still have to be given by federal court?
In that case, that's for police, so that's done by provincial courts, so not federal court. So,
So the intelligence services don't have access to
They don't
to
have
those.
That, right? So actually, CSIS has got this one-size-fits-all warrant system under Section 21 where they have to meet reasonable grounds to believe across the board, regardless of what it is that they're searching in circumstances where Section 8 is triggered, whereas the police have sort of these gradations.
So it's kind of uneven.
It is uneven, right? And it becomes increasingly uneven because when we get to IMSI, right? So for IMSI, remember we just said that for IMSI data, CSIS doesn't even need a warrant, right? Because that's one of those rare circumstances where the federal court concluded warrantless intercept is okay because of these narrow parameters that we've alluded to. Police do.
Yeah.
Right? And so...
So it's totally different on each side.
The police, if they want to get IMSI, have been going. There's been some controversy because...
Well, I can see why this could be a problem.
They've not consistently gone to court to get in this case, it would be probably transmission data. So reasonable grounds to suspect. They haven't been consistently doing that, and the privacy commissioner beat up on them over that. But generally speaking, they have been. So they're doing warrantry for police purposes. CSIS doesn't really need to do warrantry for IMSI, albeit IMSI that is very narrowly tailored. So you can see how this is basically now a cacophony of different standards depending on who's doing it and what they're doing.
So is this the basis of the Peshtari complaint?
In principle, it is, right?
Okay. There's a CSIS warrant. This is handed over to the RCMP.
Well, the information generated from the intercept, yes.
Right. And so there was already a trial which suggested that the fruit of the original tree, right, the warrant, was okay.
Yep.
And that it was okay for CSIS to pass on this information to the RCMP. That's already been ruled on.
So the issue is, can you chop down the tree? Oh, God. Right? So can you say the whole CSIS warrantry process is unconstitutional? Yeah. So the warrant was properly issued under Section 21 of the CSIS Act. But is Section 21 constitutional?
Right.
So can you chop down the tree?
Right.
And so that's the effort, to chop down the tree to get rid of the fruit that poisoned the other tree, at least from the defense
perspective. We're getting a lot of good case law out of this.
So the answer I thought was fairly clear cut back in 1988, right? So in 1988, in a case called Atwal, all right?
Oh boy.
The Federal Court of Appeal decided that in fact, the CSIS warrantry regime was constitutional, even though it had a different purpose than did the warrantry regime for police.
Right.
Right? Police are investigating crime.
Yeah.
That's because police do...
The
law enforcement
stuff,
right?
That's their job.
CSIS is investigating threats to the security of Canada. That's because CSIS does that sort of stuff. Right. So the fact that there was a difference, a discrepancy, didn't mean that the CSIS warrant regime was any less robust than the police regime. It just meant that just it was different.
Differently.
It was different. Right. And the fact that it was different didn't mean it violated Section 8. So that's what the Federal Court of Appeal decided in 1988. That decision has subsequently been sort of resuscitated in a couple of the cases from the Toronto 18, where, again, CSIS information at some point made its way over, either in seeding the police investigation or in some other way, and there was an attack then on the CSIS warrant, and the superior courts in Ontario said, look, again, you know, they're different, but they're not unconstitutional, and so these the CSIS process is fine under Section 21. Well, another kick at the can then in Peshtari, right? And so that's the objection, that because information moved from CSIS to RCMP, that somehow that made the CSIS process unconstitutional because, you know, there was this cross-fertilization.
Right.
Now, there's no evidence, by the way, that this was some kind of coordinated effort, that the CSIS was sort of nefariously conducting a de facto law enforcement investigation for some reason, which would never happen anyway for reasons of intelligence evidence that we've talked about endlessly on this show.
Oh, wait, drink.
Drink. So there was no evidence of that, although there was sort of an illusion that in the discussion about you don't want information collected under a more generous standard to find its way into the police investigation. So there are cases, for example, information from a coroner's inquiry, right?
Right.
Which the coroner can get that quite easily. If the police wanted that information, it would have to come by a warrant. Well, can you take it from the coroner, right? Can the coroner feed it to the police? No. That would be an end run on Section 8.
Yeah, because you're sneaking around right?
But the issue here is there's an end run around what, right? So it's not like CSIS is getting this information without warrant. It's getting this information with warrant, lawfully, right? And so if that regime is lawful, then what makes it unlawful if subsequently it finds something relevant to law enforcement and gives it to law enforcement? So the bottom line is the court said, nothing wrong here.
Right.
There's no unconstitutionality here.
Right.
Which is a tremendously happy conclusion, because if there was an alternative conclusion.
Oh, I can't imagine.
That would be the end. So we complained in the show that the RCMP and CSIS are two arms length to begin with, right? Because of this concern about intelligence evidence that we keep talking about. If this court had come out and said, oh, but if there's any cross-fertilization from a CSIS warrant to the police, then that somehow renders the warrantry under the CSIS Act unconstitutional. That wouldn't be two silos. That would be two planets.
Yeah.
Right. In terms of the distance that the
two
services.
It'd make it impossible.
It would make it impossible. Yeah. Right. And you don't have the same problem that they do in the U.S., right? So in the U.S., one of the problems, the controversies has been information collected under the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act.
Yeah,
FISA. Which is easier to get than being flipped over to criminal prosecutions. Right. And so there is a concern about using a more generous warrantry system and feeding in to a criminal prosecution
which
that would otherwise
narrow.
Be subject to a more rigorous system.
Yeah.
I don't see that existing here.
Right. Okay. So that's Peshtari.
That's Peshtari.
So that trial's probably, how many more roadblocks are there on that?
I don't know.
Okay. When did he make it to
And court? We haven't even got to the appeals.
Oh, good. Okay. So then we get another re-ex case. So which now... I originally thought this was Bob. It's not Bob because it's just domestic.
All these CSIS warrantry cases are called re-ex, right?
It's not Trent either.
Yeah.
So this is like a whole, they're all called re-ex, right? Because we don't say what it is, but it's probably regarding Islamist terrorism.
So this relates to the point we made a few minutes ago about basic identifier information or identifying information. BII is what the service calls it, which they're trying to get from communications providers. I understand this to be essentially telephone information and addressing information for electronic communication. So that would be things like email addresses, I assume, although I don't know because the redactions are thick here. So we know from, say, cases like Spencer, a Supreme Court decision from 2014, that what's called subscriber information, so that would be sort of nameplate or addressing information associated with subscriptions to the internet service providers, that does constitute a search if you want to get it. And you need to have some kind of warrantry there, police, before you get it. And so it's not at all surprising that the federal court concluded that this basic identifying information also attracts the protections of search and seizure under Section 8. The specific issue in play for this particular BII, I'm not quite sure it works this way, but let me just speculate. So if you have a phone number, one of the things you're going to want to do with that is contact chain it.
You want to find who's talking to who.
Right.
Okay.
And then you keep following the chain. So same with an email address.
You're trying to figure out the pattern.
Right. The university numbers for the University of Ottawa, 613-562-5800. Okay. If you have that number and then you had my extension and I was your target, you would go and you would say, okay, we want to get information about this target and who they were talking to. All right. So you go, you get your warrant. And then, of course, one step out, you're going to find other phone numbers. And you're presumably going to want to continue to follow that chain. Who was talking to who, who's talking to who's talking to, at least in principle. The problem is that very quickly, your universe of persons captured is going to include people you had no idea existed.
Right. Right. The pizza guy.
Yeah, the pizza guy or others. And so in last year, the service came to the federal court and said, we want information in respect of communication accounts corresponding to telephone numbers or electronic identifiers that may in the future come to the attention of the service in the course of its investigations in circumstances where the service really had not described or established the nexus between their investigation and those unknown persons. I mean, they're unknown persons, so you wouldn't expect them to be able to establish a nexus, right?
Right.
So can you give us sort of a carte blanche to allow us to contact chain in this way? And the federal court said no.
Yeah.
And you got to understand both perspectives, right? The service is going to like, oh, every time we collect another number, we have to come back through this warrantry process at the federal court and get approval. And this is going to be enormous undertaking because it's not just going to the court, right? This is an internal process. The service has to do it. They have to get approval from the Minister of Public Safety or their delegate. Then they have to go to court, right? So there's this whole process they have to follow, which if you're talking about these modern electronic communications might be quite laborious. On the other hand, from the privacy perspective, if you don't have that, you're going to have a whole bunch of people swept into the investigation whose personal information has never been subjected to judicial oversight in terms of the capacity of the state to collect it.
Right. We get closer to that question of like, well, should intelligence services just be fishing
right
out there?
Yeah. And so the court, you can understand both perspectives. In this case, the court said, no, we're not going to give you a carte blanche.
Yeah.
And so the case that came out last week is the response, right? So we don't get a carte blanche. What do we get? So in the latest case, the court was willing to authorize production from communication service providers of these indicators where CSIS demonstrated the required nexus between the electronic identifiers and CSIS's investigation into the threat posed to the security of Canada, and they do actually say Islamist terrorism. So we have confirmation that's what this is about.
Okay.
All right. And so there has to be a nexus. There is this requirement of a nexus. And this is a fairly long case, and there was all sorts of motion work done by the service as to, do we really need to go all the way to the Minister of Public Safety every time, or can we take a shortcut? They withdrew that one. They didn't wait for the court's deliberation on that one.
Yeah.
So they've put in place a protocol now, and it seems that the protocol is as follows. A fresh application every time with a fresh affidavit that provides, and so affidavit in this case would be from the CSIS officer, providing facts relied upon to satisfy that there was this nexus, a fresh designation and approval by the minister.
Every time.
And in urgent situations where it's not possible to get the minister's designation or approval, in writing, it will suffice for the Justice Department to advise the federal court that they have received an oral confirmation and to follow up with writing as soon as possible. So that's the protocol, three-step protocol. It seems to be from this.
So every time they get a new number, they have to do that.
Pretty much. That's what it sounds like.
Wow, that's a lot.
Yeah. So the issue is whether you could come up with something more rudimentary that's more efficient. Because attention here is always going to be about
data set.
Well, data set, sort of, right? So just to circle back then to our conversation about what the police can do.
Yeah.
So keep in mind that the service has got to do this for every BII new person and has to do so on a reasonable grounds to believe standard, probability standard, right? Probability that there are a threat to the security of Canada. Whereas the police, if they were doing contact chaining with metadata, they would still need the specificity, but they could do so on a reasonable grounds to suspect standard. So if we can do that with the police, could we have a new sort of bespoke, high-tech oriented warrantry system for the service that would minimize this sort of burdensome system, but would still allow the court to be invested perhaps in a more efficient way in approving this process? And I think the answer is we're going to have to do some more legislative renovation. And I think certainly there's considerable acceptance of this, my sense is, that this one-size-fits-all Section 21 warrantry system for the service worked for 1984.
But
doesn't work anymore. And so maybe we should do some tinkering where we can reconcile some of these issues that the court has to weigh in on.
Yeah, because this
legislatively,
is, yeah,
rather than having to work it out in a quasi-adversarial, in this case, it is an adversarial system because even though these warrants are done in camera ex parte, that is without the target and behind closed court, there's an amicus who's fighting tooth and nail, right? So can we do this balancing exercise legislatively in some way that would make this run more efficiently? And we'll wait and see. I mean, I think
we can't even get C59 through, but
I'm optimistic we'll get C59 through, but there's a lot of work to be done, right?
Okay. So let's get going here because
we're going on.
So is that the main finding? So basically CSIS has come up with a
workaround.
Still very laborious workaround, but has found a way to basically make that work.
In the present environment, I don't see how it could do anything else. I mean, I think the court was right.
Okay.
All right. So
to err on the side of privacy.
Yeah, because that's the court's job.
Okay.
Right. It's to protect privacy interests, Section 8, and I don't know how you could have. You just can't give them a carte blanche. You can't say to them, look, yeah, we don't know who you're going to be sweeping into your investigation. You can, you know, keep going and keep going, right? I just don't see that that's within the jurisdiction of the court right now.
I agree. It's like, it does seem like we're missing a useful middle step here, or a useful middle way.
Whether you could legislate a useful middle step that would, you know, be some kind of, it's not quite a warrant, it's like a warrant, it's a reasonable law applied reasonably sort of thing.
Yeah.
Is, I think, the interesting legislative drafting exercise.
Right.
But I don't think you can make it up on the go in court.
Right. Okay. So do we want to get to Vice Media?
Vice Media.
So this is the case. Ben McCooch, whose work actually I love. Like, he does really good work on violent extremism of all kinds. And so he was writing about far-right nationalism most recently. But this is, again, the story that we already talked about regarding Sheridan, who's dead. And the court basically ruled that the RCMP production order was acceptable, was legal. It wasn't like a super generous reading, but they said, I believe it's my understanding that because it was open source, or this was a person who didn't want their information protected, that they wanted to get their information out there, that there was, this person didn't that, essentially that was have a the consideration. Right to protection. Yeah.
Right. So the policy issue here, and by policy, I mean basically the balancing dilemma. And so we talked about Section 8 a second ago. So there's Section 8 issues here, obviously, right?
Yes.
There's also Section 2 issues under the charter. So Section 2, freedom of thought, belief, opinion, and expression, including freedom of the press.
Right.
And other media of communication, right? And so the concern here is you don't want the media to be a proxy for law enforcement. And so if media can go out and do their investigations and the police, knock, 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 thank you very much. Now we're going to proceed with all the information you were given by your sources and off to the races we go in terms of our criminal investigation, then you're going to impair the functions of the media in a free and democratic society, right?
Yes, and very important.
So that's a consideration here. So for a long time, for more than a generation, in something called the Lessard case, the Supreme Court has superimposed a balancing exercise in circumstances where you're seeking a warrant, or in this case, it's a production order, you're seeking papers against the media, whether it's confidential or non-confidential sources. When you're seeking that sort of lawful access, you have to take into account not just the law enforcement advantages to having that information, but also the implications for expression and media. Right. And so you have to do this. I think in its original iteration, there was 9 steps, right? Because a 9-step balancing exercise that you had to go through. Right. So it's a very complicated system. And the argument being made here by Vice was that wasn't sufficiently protective. That wasn't sufficiently protective. The majority of the court says, yes, it is, with some minor modifications.
Right.
Because it's not a carte blanche. I mean, it's not like what police seek from the judge in terms of production orders, police will get. There is a vetting by the judges, and the judges are supposed to take into account all these concomitant implications of seeking information against the media. And by the way, the media, it's not like you are insulated. You're not carved off from the rest of society, and you're allowed to house information.
They have to be specially protected, but that doesn't mean they're above everything.
Exactly. So it is a balance. And the court says the balance set in this case called Lessard is more or less still acceptable, and we're going to tinker with it a little bit. We don't have to get into the details. We don't have time. But the tinkering is relatively modest. And so at the end of the day, the court looked at what the court had done in this Vice case and had said the lower court got it right, essentially. Now, the knock-on to this is this Journalistic Source Protection Act that we talked about in, I went back to it, episode 5, right, before we had good mics. And that was a private members bill that the government embraced and became law. It was a Senate private members bill and became law. And it would change the way this works procedurally. So now when the police seek any kind of warrant, really, whether it's production order or some kind of invasive electronic surveillance that implicate media or media documents, they have to go through this special process. And the special process really has two balancing. There's the balancing in terms of the issuance of the warrant, and I don't think it's going to be substantively any different than what the Supreme Court says in Vice. You're supposed to take into account, you know, whatever the 9 steps, I think they reduced it to 4 in the Supreme Court decisions in Vice. I mean, it's like a shorter list, but it still takes into account, you know, the probative value, that is the significance of the evidence for the criminal case versus the possible chilling effect on media. So all these things you have to take into account constitutionally. Well, so too you're going to have to take into account under this new act. So that's the first balancing. Do you get to get, actually intercept or collect this information from the media? Procedurally, one difference is there's going to be a special advocate, right? So there's the court has the discretion now to appoint a special advocate to represent the public interest, or in practice here, the media interest, in deciding whether to issue one of these warrants. Typically, it's just, you know, the police officer and the Crown Counsel, and that's it. Now you've got someone who's duty-bound or potentially duty-bound, because it's not there's no obligation to appoint a special advocate, but where they exist, who's going to take an adversarial position and really press hard. And that's important, because the special advocates in other contexts have made a difference. So that's the first balancing exercise. The second balancing exercise, whatever you collect, police, in terms of documents, and I think also, I'm not sure about this, but I think a wiretap that's reduced then to a transcript, that has to be sealed. And the police don't have access to it until the media has an opportunity to weigh in. And then you redo the balancing exercise on the second prong.
At least where the media can persuade a judge that a confidential source may be outed through a review of the documents.
So because of this new Source Protection Act, it doesn't change Vice Media in the sense that the test substantively will be the same, but it does procedurally change the way this works in a way that I think advantages the media relative to what exists at present.
Okay. So basically the upshot is that Vice Media did have to turn over this information, but journalists shouldn't be too disheartened by that, because the process is now actually arguably more favorable to them.
Yeah, we'll wait and see what happens under this new act.
Right. Yeah. Okay. And that's passed.
It was passed last year.
Okay. So that's kind of our three major warrantry cases. Is there anything that you take away from this generally, other than saying the word warrantry?
Yeah. So, I mean, one of the takeaways, the one main takeaway is our warrantry system is a hodgepodge. Right?
Yes.
Different standards for different agencies, different strokes for different folks.
But that's not necessarily a bad thing, given that they do very different things.
Possibly. But the problem is when they start shaking hands. So
if a looser warrant system then comes up against a tighter warrant system,
You have accusations about end runs.
Right.
Then you get into more difficult constitutional terrain. And so if you're going to have police and security intelligence services working more closely together, you want to make sure that their respective regimes are not going to be prey to this end run situation. And I think that's true, by the way, for CSE, right? So that's why one of the reasons we've said before, why having an intelligence commissioner bless the minister authorization that allows the intercept, however incidentally, of private communications, putting that on a constitutional footing means that you bring CSE within the constitutional house, so that you will never be accused if for some weird way CSE information ends up directly or indirectly in
helping an RCMP investigation.
Right?
Yeah.
You don't run the risk of a rerun of this Pesteri case that ends up knocking out everything all the way back to the CSE intercept, right? So putting everything on an even keel constitutionally, I think, is really important to avoid the domino effects having a very prejudicial impact on the ability of these agencies to work together.
Is this in Craig legal fantasy world? Well, or is this a realistic thing?
So C-59 is important, right? Because it does that. I think it does that.
You think it makes
CSE.
Everything more equal?
For CSE.
Equal. Yeah.
I think there's work to be done for CSIS warrantry.
Clearly. I think that's what I take away from this is like how difficult that warrant system is.
And then, you know, Section 16, we've talked about that, the foreign intelligence and the geographic scope, all that sort of stuff needs to be modernized.
Sounds fun.
I think the production order regime for police is a total mess, right? Different production order standards for different circumstances. Could you clean that up? I don't know. I mean, I don't pretend to have a silver bullet. But basically what we do is we just knee-jerk, right? We knee-jerk, respond to a court case, change the law, respond to another court case, change the law. No one sat down and done on a whole scale from stem to stern. Is this a rational system revamp? Yeah, whether we're capable of that, I don't know. But it might be a useful exercise.
Okay, I think our audience wants to go for dinner. So we better, let's talk about Sharkawi quickly.
Quickly. So Sharkawi, Mr. Sharkawi, subject to a security certificate.
This is a gentleman who is in Quebec. Right. Never charged.
So okay. He was subject to an immigration security certificate.
That was it, right.
He's a non-national.
Yeah.
Subject to removal, right? And he was the named individual who went up to the Supreme Court twice in Sharkawi, what we call Sharkawi 1 and Sharkawi 2, 2007, 2008, fighting the constitutionality of the security certificate regime, which precipitated the introduction of special advocates to create an adversarial system in the secret hearings
right.
that are associated with security certificates. So what happens in this case after...
So in other words, just to put it in plain English, basically all these trials result in the fact that we now have...
They're not trials. They're not criminal proceedings. Not trials, but they're decisions. Administrative proceedings, basically, right. for removal purposes.
Right. And so, but basically it now mandates that you have someone who comes in and challenges the government as viciously as they can.
Right. In the closed proceedings is access to the secret information.
Right.
So, and that restores an element of adversarialism and also procedural fairness.
Right.
So what happens after Sharkawi 2? Sharkawi 2 was really a decision from the Supreme Court that said, by the way, CSIS, you got to cough up more information for the judge and the special advocates because you're not coughing up and you're not retaining enough.
Right.
And so what happens thereafter is more information comes out.
Oh, this is because information had been destroyed.
Right. Yeah.
And then,
So more information comes out to the federal court and the special advocates. In the Sharkawi case, Justice Trombley Lemaire, who was the designated judge at the federal court, says, all right, well, I'm looking at all this information, CSIS and government, you're claiming has to be held secret away from Mr. Sharkawi. I don't think it does have to be held secret. I want you to cough it up in public. It becomes part of the public record. The government says, we can't live with that. And so we're going to withdraw that information. Having withdrawn that information, there's not enough information anymore to sustain the security certificate. And so the case craters. And so Mr. Sharkawi's security certificate goes away. Mr. Sharkawi then sues.
Right. This is about the suing.
This is about the suing. So this is a civil action brought in Quebec. And he's suing for a number of other things too, but basically suing for damages. And of course, in order to prove his case, he needs evidence.
Right.
And so he needs disclosure from the government.
You're teeing something up
here, Craig. I can't imagine what you're teeing up. No, we're not going to actually disclose this. And the information you want is privileged because it's national security confidences, and it's privileged under Section 38 of the Canada Evidence Act, and we're not obliged to disclose it. And so when they invoke Section 38, it goes back to federal court, and the federal court has to do, there's a test it has to adopt in deciding whether it will order this information disclosed for purposes of the underlying trial or not. Now, and I'm not going to go into the test, but the bottom line, the issue here is something called the third party doctrine, otherwise known as originator control. Because a lot of the information that became part of this latest decision from the federal court was information supplied by services, foreign services.
Right.
That's subject to caveats.
So for example, let's say the Swiss have a lot of information.
Yeah, or the Moroccans, who are actually one of the named states here.
Oh, okay. I wasn't going to go there, but that's fine. But like if another country has information, you could say, look, we want you to know this, but you can't give this.
And you being CSIS.
You being CSIS, yeah. But you can't disseminate any of this information without letting us know.
Yeah, without our consent.
Or without our consent, basically. And that includes use in court and law.
Yeah.
Right? Because one of the most important jobs of a security intelligence service is to protect its sources and methods. This is true universally. So, you know, they don't want their sources and methods blown either.
Yeah. And we are acutely sensitive of this concept of originator control because we're a net recipient of intelligence. And if it dries up, we're hooped, right?
Yeah, I was going to say, as a consuming nation.
We are absolutely preoccupied with this, as are other countries. And this is where some of the Trump stuff comes out, right? And so, you know, what is Trump saying to whom in the White House, in the Oval Office, to the Russians when they're visiting, outing intelligence from the Israeli services, right?
Yeah.
And so there's this sensitivity about other people's stuff getting spilled. And by stuff here, we mean other people's secrets.
And that was in the worst possible way.
Yeah. So originator control is this kind of universal principle. It's not a principle of law, but it's a practice. For good reason.
Because if you don't have that, then intelligence sharing between countries just dies.
Right. And so here, the court had to decide to what degree was it going to honor the third party principle or originator control. And basically there were, depending on how you unpack them, three categories of information. There was information where the service went back to the originator and said, will you release it? And the originator either said no or didn't answer. There was information that the originator said, yes, you can release it. And then there was the prospect that the service didn't go back.
Right.
Right. And so the rule is you have to at least go back. Right. Okay. And that was established about a decade ago.
Right.
So you have to at least go back and ask. If you go back and you ask and the service says, the foreign service says no or doesn't respond, then the question is, will the court nevertheless order disclosure? And here the court said, no, we won't. The third party rule is too important.
Okay. Yeah. Wow.
Now, of course, if the originator says, yes, you can disclose it, well, then there should be no further objection.
Okay.
And that actually happened in one case here with the Moroccan information.
Right.
So it's a pretty good overview of the third party rule. And so the court will honor the idea that third party rule matters. But procedurally, they want the government to ask whether the caveat will be relaxed or not.
Right. Oh, right. So you have to at least make the effort.
That hasn't always
been... You can't
been,
just assume... Basically, the court's saying to the to CSIS, you can't just assume that the answer's no.
Yeah. And in fact, there have been instances where the government said, we don't even want to ask because it'll suggest we're wobbly on secrecy. And the court hasn't accepted that.
No. You know, because there's so much on America. We don't really focus on America. But like one of the things I do worry about is, you know, we do so much intelligence sharing and things like this with the Americans that if there is doubt that the information that we provide is safe, we won't have cooperation, right? And Mr. Trump has cast doubt on a lot of these things, and it's something that we worry about. But that's not really our bailiwick. Yeah. But now, it does affect Canadian national security.
Yeah. Now, to go one step further, by the way, if you had a circumstance where it was a criminal trial and that issue was the prospect of someone going to prison and they had fair trial rights were quite robust as they are in a criminal proceeding, and the court said, no, we're not going to disclose this, and yet that information was exculpatory, then there's a good chance the trial court, having been apprised of that, which is possible through a special advocate, the trial court would said no fair trial, end of the prosecution.
Okay.
Right. So.
So in other words, if information. Right. So if there's information about someone, and it's from foreign intelligence, and that foreign intelligence basically shows that the person's innocent, and the court sees this in a ex parte trial. Expert hearing.
So there's a Section 38. In Section 38, they say no. The security consequences are too dire, and it's not going to be disclosed.
But then the court realizes that this person's innocent.
The trial court, which is going to be the different court, says, but now the person can't have a fair trial. Then that would crater the prosecution.
Okay.
Yeah. So now that would be a criminal context, which is different from this.
Okay. This was a very lengthy journey into the fun world of courts and warrantry. I will thank the audience for their patience. And,
Stephanie's eyes have glazed over.
A few times.
About 15 minutes in.
I'm learning. Like I said, I'm going to get my law degree from Podcast U, and it's going to be great. But so we'll be back eventually with some more fun. Are we expecting any more reports or anything? I think CSE is planning some reports. Certainly, they've promised things about kind of general cyber threats. We're expecting threats about democracy sometime in 2019. That report's going to come out. So there should be those.
More NISICOP too.
More NISICOP fun.
Yeah, the annual report should be out reasonably soon, I think.
Yeah, so we'll be back hopefully.
On intelligence priorities and foreign intelligence in the national defense.
The holiday report festival will hopefully still happen before the actual holidays, but we'll be back soon.
And hopefully some pod sites as well. Thanks very much, everyone.